Hello, and welcome to Music Maps, the Rock and Roll Book Club podcast. In each episode, we'll use a place as a jumping-off point for a conversation about music, anywhere from the obvious to the obscure. So, Simon, it's another one of our music maps. Yes. What are we up to? Is this the 300th or 4th? I've lost track.
Fourth.
Excellent. Are we actually coming to the capital city for the first time ever?
We are. This is episode 4, and it's our first stop in London.
And we are going not right in the centre, are we? We're not going to be so obvious as that. We are going to go to Willesden Green.
NW10.
NW10. And it gets better and better. Our guest is, as very much as we'll find out, a citizen of the world, so very much, yeah. But for the purposes of today, she's going to be our guide to Willesden Green, NW10, and other funky parts of London. Because today, Simon, I can't believe I'm saying this, we've got Mickey Berenny of Lush and Piroshka and other things, the author of the amazing memoir, Fingers Crossed.
Yeah, so obviously Mickey's book, Fingers Crossed, has been out now about 18 months or so, published by 9/8 Books. It's got quite a lot about the early part of her life, which is mostly centred around Willesden Green, which is here in northwest London, NW10 postcode. Not an area that I know a lot about, you might not either. And then obviously we move on to Lush after that. So first question, Mickey, was there an emotional trigger for writing this book?
No, there was a financial trigger.
Right.
So I didn't, it's not like I had the book written and was then looking for a publisher. I was approached by 9/8. Or in fact, Peter Selby was just setting up 9/8, I think. And he just approached me to write a book. It took me a while to sort of agree because I just thought it's just not something that had ever occurred to me to do.
It was brilliant to see the reception that your book received. And it's not a kind of straightforward rock and roll memoir. In fact, the first part of the book centres on your childhood and early life and obviously features a particularly charismatic figure, your dad, Ivan. Ivan or Ivan?
Well, the Hungarians would call him Ivan. And then, but all his, you know, British friends would call him Ivan. So he was quite happy to go with either.
But but your dad, I mean, obviously important figure in this first part of the book. So how would you describe him?
I mean, he was, look, you know, he was quite, it was very charismatic, very clever, a lot of fun, quite adventurous, and that tipped into recklessness and kind of quite a lot of selfishness, if I'm honest. There wasn't really anything dark about him, I'd say. I mean, I was chatting about him to someone, and it's quite difficult to describe someone who you know kind of so, so well. And I'm aware that having written the book, like some people will form this sort of idea of him as this like terrible person, whereas other people have said, oh God, he sounds like he was great fun. But I think, you know, he was sort of, he didn't really have boundaries. But I do know that he was the sort of person who would slightly bullyingly insist that you join him on some insane adventure. And it would almost be a test of your own character. Like either you come out of it going, okay, that was nuts, but it was fucking great fun, or you would never speak to him again.
So he met your mum at the Tokyo Olympic, right?
Yes. So he'd come over to this country in 1956 when there was a lot of Hungarians who came over to kind of escape the Soviet communist regime. And he ended up being a sports writer. So he went to the Tokyo Olympics and that's where they met.
So your mum was an actress?
Not initially.
Not at that
no.
point.
She, I think she had plans to become like an English teacher or something in Japan. Like she studied English and she loved literature. I mean, her parents effectively would have wanted to arrange a marriage for her to a doctor, probably, because her dad was a doctor and her brother had to become a doctor. Didn't have any choice about that. And so I think a lot of her kind of eloping with my dad was escaping the kind of constraints of that. And she, it just never occurred to her to be an actress until she came to London and she just got offered a part.
Right.
So
it happened almost by accident.
It happened totally by accident, yeah.
And then she ends up being in TV programmes and films and things?
I think she was in a thing called The Protectors. And, you know, she was in You Only Live Twice. That was the big kind of, oh, she was in a Bond film. She was in, what are the things I remember? I do remember her being in Ain't Half Hot Mum as Windsor Davis's love interest. I think there was a double episode. Someone actually sent me a clip from it, which I thought was hilarious.
Space 1999?
Space 1999. Yes, yeah, she was a regular in that. She took her career massively seriously because I think she was just very typecast. So there was no, you know, back in... It's quite interesting now. You see a lot of films where, you know, especially American films where Asians are kind of cast like... Not because they have to be Asian, like they're just cast as a normal person, right? Yeah. You know what I mean? But back then it was like you would only be cast if you were an Asian person. Yeah. Like you would have to be the, you know, the kind of Singaporean housemaid or the Vietnamese refugee or the, you know what I mean? Those were the only parts you would have got. I mean, there is a lot of like kind of exotic stuff in my history. Yeah, it's a fair amount of privilege as well. You know, I did go, I mean, I went to state schools as well, but I went to private schools as well. You know, my parents owned their own properties. Do you know what I mean? I didn't grow up on a council estate or anything like that, even though I lived in a pretty sort of shabby area of London. So it's got a kind of real, you know, I think I had that even in Lush, you know, me and Emma having met at Queen's College, it was always this, oh, they went to private school, they're really privileged, blah, blah, blah. But I think the thing about those stories is if you dig a little deeper, I mean, you know, I'm not going to get into some competitive poverty misery memoir kind of thing, but it's just that so weirdly, I think I had the sort of assumption, especially of people in the music industry who deify that kind of working class background.
Yeah.
It was... like that I actually felt like no one ever explored the truth of what, you know, my background was, or Emma's actually, which was way more interesting than any of those people had. I've had music journalists go to me, you never talked about this stuff in interviews. And I was like, well, you didn't fucking ask, you know, you just wrote me off as some middle class girl. And that was the fucking end.
There's a lot of great music been made by people who have come from privileged backgrounds, but you know, it's something that kind of gets glossed over sometimes. But
well, I wouldn't mind if half the bloody journalists who were writing about it didn't come from fairly privileged backgrounds Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So you're living in Willesden Green at this point?
I mean, you know, the house that I was brought up in, my dad was the one who ended up living there. So although my mum left, you know, it was actually bought with her parents' money, right? But my mum was the sort who would kind of just up, you know, she just left the house, really. So it was a big house, but my dad was not a practical man. And it just, if you imagine buying a house and never fixing anything in it ever.
That's actually not hard to imagine. Apologies, wife.
Or getting anyone else in to fix it is all I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah.
So whatever deteriorated, just deteriorated and fell to pieces and, you know, kind of, you know, I don't think there was ever a time that a carpet got replaced or a light fitting was changed. There was nothing. It was just You know, I remember a huge damp patch on the wall of the living room that my dad just bitched about the neighbours having done something, but never fixed, right? And I think there's a bit in the book where eventually, you know, I had like quite a big bedroom upstairs, but there was one, all the kind of woodwork around the windows had rotted, and one day the like entire kind of half wall of window just blew out into the street, and I had a sort of bin bags covering it for about 6 months. Like, never got fixed, you know. It's just ridiculous.
Of course, it's not so long, you know, it's only a generation and a bit ago. You know, there are places now which are just probably just lived in by Russian bankers, you know, were derelict and, you know, that genteel poverty. So I think you paint a picture very much of what that was like, not the upper end of the privilege. Now, for anybody who hasn't yet read Fingers Crossed, and indeed those who have, what very quickly established, this is a very personal account in this book. And there are some difficult subjects. I mean, some, you know, stop you in the track moments.
I think the point is that I was only willing to talk about issues and things that had happened that are controversial and can clearly, I don't know, trigger people, or you have to handle them kind of very carefully. Like, I didn't want it to just be a sort of list of look at these terrible things that happened to me, because I just don't think that's very helpful. So I think unless you've got a reason for talking about those things, like if you feel that they are, you know, part of, if they explain some of your own trajectory or your own kind of behaviour or your own character, or that they have taught you something about the world. You know, I did write about sexual abuse, not least because I think it's quite unusual, or I don't know how unusual it is, because it is generally and understandably framed as a male crime.
Yeah.
And I do think it's unusual to have an, you know, a woman perpetrate that. And I thought it was, it did make me think, although I was then abused by men as well, that, you know, and like, I didn't want to just list everything that had happened, but I do think how abuse can have, like, it's not just a sort of isolated incident, you know, it changes you, it makes you think about sex a certain way, it can,
of course, yeah,
lead you down certain avenues. And I think I'm sort of interested in that idea of how character is pushed down certain pathways because of the experiences that you have. And I also wanted to write about it in a way, a lot of abuse is written about, and understandably that might be people's experience, that it, you know, destroyed their lives, or that it led them to kind of, you know, terrible exploitation and, you know, whatever. But, you know, there are other stories. Not that I'm in any way saying like, oh no, I think it was quite good for me. Obviously not. But I just think it's a subject that sometimes gets a bit like there's one narrative. And I just think that with anything, whether it's, you know, whether, you know, I wrote about abortion, or I wrote about, you know, suicide and all of these things, you know, I just think the more stories you have about individual nuanced experiences, the more understanding there would be about them personally.
Yeah. And I think that's reflected in how people have received the book.
So it was your grandmother, Nora, who we haven't mentioned yet. So she came over to live with your dad from Hungary?
Right? Well, he bloody bought her over.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, Nora, you know, she was, again, I just think I only knew her when she was, I mean, probably in her 60s, I suppose, when I was born. I think she was already completely nuts. You know, I can't really diagnose her in retrospect. You know, I can't really say, was she demented? I only discovered after she died that she was an alcoholic. My dad was like, well, obviously she was an alcoholic. And I said, I didn't bloody know. Mm. I thought, you know, she's sipping at her Advocar all night. I don't think I even knew there was alcohol in it. And, you know, so I have no idea what turned her into the person that she was turned into. I can only speculate. And she was a Nazi. But, you know, I've had You know, the funny thing is when you say, like, you know, I talk to lots of people in these interviews and they go like, oh my God, so your grandmother was a Nazi. And I did an interview with a girl who was German and she was sort of saying to me like, well, it's not uncommon if you're from certain parts of the world to have had a Nazi grandmother, right? You know, and I did think, yeah, good point, right?
So when does your mum move over to LA?
So they separated when I was about four.
Yeah, right.
And then
okay.
they lived, you know, so my mum lived in Maida Avenue. Then she moved to Windsor with Ray. She married Ray Austin, who was a stuntman, kind of turned TV director.
Yeah.
And we lived in Windsor for a while, and I was mainly at school there. And then, because of his career, really, they moved to Los Angeles and to Hollywood. And I do think, you know, it's one of those things, I don't remember it being particularly, like, it's not, you know, like they say, all trauma kind of has this sort of, you know, deep memory thing. And I don't really remember a lot of it. So I kind of struggled to remember the order. And I did ask my mum, and I was digging through paperwork and stuff. It took me a while to figure out that actually, yeah, she moved when I was in kind of probably first year of secondary school. And it was around that period. But I don't remember it really clearly. And I think when I thought about it, it kind of explained a lot of my behaviour around that time. I suddenly realised, God, I must have actually been...
Yeah, when you look back later, yeah.
...pretty freaked out that they were going, because I suddenly was getting bullied at one school and all sorts of weird things happened and I had to move schools. And then I think, oh, well, I must have been quite stressed about that, that... And I had to choose who I was going to live with. So that was quite difficult.
Yeah. So you decided to stay in London?
I mean, yeah. You know, I think my mum, poor mum, you know, I think she still feels quite bruised by the rejection. But, you know, I'm always saying to her, it wasn't really, it's not you I was rejecting, it was Ray. I didn't really like Ray, you know, for a multitude of reasons, some of which are just quite, probably quite unfair. And that kind of stepchild perspective. You're not my real dad, you know.
Yeah.
But I think I'd already been shunted around enough, like I'd had enough of it. It's not easy constantly being the new kid at school, coming in halfway through a year when everybody's already bloody made friends with each other.
Yeah.
And you're foreign and you're a girl. So everywhere you go and you're going, oh, we're going to send her to a private school. No, now we're going to send her to a state school. So you're too posh for one school and then too fucking poor for another. So it's just so jarring. Do you know what I mean? I just thought, I just can't do this anymore. I can't go and live in America and be in this other, like, completely different environment.
So one thing that you mentioned, how you didn't really hear much music at home and you didn't really intend to be in a band particularly later on, but was it around this time when you start to get interested in music?
I think music came mostly from school. You know, I wasn't listening to fucking Rachmaninoff or digging out, you know, old blues records when I was 5 years old. But I think I had, you know, a kind of love of music that all kids have. And it's a good way to, you know, at school, when I went to a school in Ladbroke Grove, that was a state school, there was I do distinctly remember like Gary Newman and a lot of that's kind of ska music was, you know, really popular and actually almost kind of boning up on it in
so
a way to keep up.
Bands that you became interested in.
Madness.
I did
Select,
that.
All of
so
that.
I know this isn't about me, but just to illustrate that, I understand what you're saying. So for me, I remember there was that period where suddenly, in a free period, I was sitting at a desk with three people and they were all listening to John Peel and I wasn't really aware of that. So I kind of started listening to it and then I started to, you know, as you progress, you buy the enemy or something. I remember I became very knowledgeable about stuff and could take part in a conversation and then I left school and had no one to talk to about it. That's why I joined bands. But so I think I understand, yeah, you fall into a group and whether you want to fit in or indeed just because it's interesting, And you've just said, you're at a time when music is utterly fascinating. Gary Newman, the two-tone, all that stuff. So, yeah, get that.
I mean, I do think there is something instinctive about it, because I do think, you know, I went to schools where girls were really into horses.
Yeah.
Right, I never fucking got into horses. You know, I went to schools where girls, you know, certainly by the time I was at Queen's, there were lots of girls who were really into fashion. I wasn't into fashion. Do you know what I mean? So I do think there's
so you
probably...
You didn't share their common interests.
I can get that there's an aptitude, and maybe that, you know, that's the thing that engages you and it actually brings you some sort of excitement. I'm not going to lie as well. I think my mate Maxine said this when we were talking about how we got into music, and she did describe it as, well, it was quite hormonal. And I thought, I know what you mean. It was quite like...
So Maxie's a childhood friend of yours.
Yeah, she was at Queen's with like me and Emma, and we had this little group of us. But I do, you know, that is another attraction that, you know, lots of girls get into pop bands because they fancy the, you know.
Did you have posters on your wall? Did
loads.
You?
No.
Yeah.
Because so all of those magazines had free posters.
Yeah. So who was on your wall?
Julian Cope.
Yeah.
Teardrop Explodes.
Debbie Harry. I had an Echo and the Bunnymen poster. I remember Duran Duran for sure. I would have had a Duran poster. It was quite jumbled up, you know, because the posters kind of stayed up. I didn't really care that much about trying to look cool. So, like, you know, the Japan poster would be up at the same time as the fall poster. Like, that didn't matter.
And Emma lives above a naval club on Piccadilly.
Not above.
Oh.
At the front, you know, basically her dad was...
Is that
a real,
the In-N-Out Club?
The In-N-Out Club,
right, yeah.
So their apartments were, I think, as you came in on the left, on the ground floor at the front of the building. And because he had this kind of really illustrious kind of army career, and when he retired, he, you know, became the, you know, I don't know what the term is, you know, but he was basically running the club. So, you know, like if you're a vicar or something, you get free accommodation in the church or the parish. Like, he got the accommodation there. So we would go round to Emma's, because Queen's College was in Harley Street and then In-N-Out Club was in Piccadilly. So it was walking distance.
Did Emma have a horse?
Not on Piccadilly,
I think she has ridden the horses.
It was handy for Hyde Park, you see. I mean, you know,
she was very good on a horse, because when we went to record at Rockfield, we got, like, the daughter of Kingsley took us out on horses. I mean, I was clinging to this animal for dear fucking life, and Emma was off, like, you know, leaping over hedges and God knows what. So, yeah, she'd had a horsey time at some point. But anyway, she was at the In-N-Out Club, and that you would get... I remember her mum didn't have to cook, because you could order scampi and chips and it would come up in a dumbwaiter. And... that's where I had my first taste of cider. Her mum used to give us cider. I didn't even know it had fucking alcohol in it. And I did say, no wonder we're always completely crazy at Emma's, because we're all bloody pissed.
So when do you start the fanzine?
I think we were about... possibly about 17.
What inspired that? What fanzines? I'm presuming you got some fanzines and said, oh, that looks interesting.
I think what happened was we started going to gigs you know, it was the classic, well, you know, when we were first going to gigs, we were going to big gigs. It was at the Hammersmith Palais or the Hammersmith Odeon. It was chart bands, but we quite quickly worked our way down the rankings, and, you know, within a few months, you're kind of going to, I don't know, downstairs at the Clarendon or whatever the fuck it is, right? You know, smaller and smaller gigs and marquee and all of that. And I think gigs were very, very cheap. We didn't really drink. I mean, we would have, like, you know, we would share half a cider and be, you know, out of it. And so we could go, and we were quite unsupervised, particularly me and Emma. So we would go to quite a lot of gigs. But we were very, very young and quite shy about meeting people. And you know, there were so many people selling fanzines at the time. And and it was easiest to get talking to the fanzine writers, because they'd sell you a fanzine. Yeah. And then, you know, that was kind of a good opener, really. And we thought, oh, well, maybe we should do a fanzine then. Yeah. And we could be part of this community. So we just decided to write a fanzine.
I'm fascinated by fanzines at the moment. And last year, again, we looked at a couple of books which examined fanzines. I know there's still people putting them out.
Yeah.
But I feel it's a great jump in. I know you didn't become an NME journalist as a consequence of your fanzine, but many people did. But is that, as you've just described, it's a great way of getting in to that scene.
There was a lot of kind of DIY culture around that time.
Yeah.
And, whenever people have asked me about, how you got into music and blah, blah, blah. I think if you being part of that scene, everyone was doing something, there's a lot of people on the dole, so they had a lot of time. There was a kind of real squat culture, so people didn't necessarily have to earn a lot of money. And people did fanzines, they did, they might open they might run a venue. A lot of them worked for like student unions putting on bands. People made bootleg tapes and sold them at Camden Market. People were art students and did fashion and art stuff and sold it at Portobello. So there was quite a lot of kind of creativity swilling around. People didn't just necessarily go to gigs as, it did feel more
merely
like
a participant,
scene.
A viewer.
You didn't buy your kind of gig ticket 8 months in advance.
No.
You just rocked up on the night and thought, probably the same. Sometimes you just go and see a band you'd never heard of because you've pre-smartphones. Half the people didn't even have a phone in their fucking house. So you'd kind of think, if there was someone you fancied and you thought, I wonder if they'll be at that gig. So you'd go along on the off chance might actually be there.
Were you an avid reader of the music press? Was that where you found out about gigs, through the gig list things, or was it just because you were fairly close?
Well, the NME was great for the gig list.
Yeah.
If I'm honest, I probably bought it more for the gig list than I did for the content.
Yeah.
Because I did like music papers. I actually found reading that deeply about music quite boring.
Yeah.
But then I think it's partly because we were quite spoiled in that we lived in London. You could just go and see these bands. Like, I totally get it if you're living in the middle of fucking nowhere and there's no bands playing. Of course you want to read every word about them in those papers. We didn't really have to.
That's what I used to do.
Well, exactly. But then there's a reason. If they're literally playing on your doorstep, you think,
we didn't have access to it.
I'm just going to go and see them.
If my dad wasn't willing to drive us to the gig, we weren't going to the gig.
Yeah. So.
So the fanzine's called Alphabet Soup. And then I guess not long after this, you start to join bands. So you and Emma both.
Yeah. So I think Emma joined the Rover Girls when she started at Ealing College. She met a bunch of people there and she joined. Actually, she was sharing a flat with Chris P, who ended up in Silverfish. And we knew from gigs. It's all very kind of interconnected, do you know what I mean? And I then joined the Bugs, who I was going out
great
with.
Great name. The Bugs.
Who were kind of 60s garage kind of band.
Obviously.
It's amazing that name wasn't already taken.
I know, it's quite funny, isn't it?
I wouldn't be surprised if there were, but I'm not calling you on that. It's a great name. Well done. I like it.
But they were kind of pre-existing, so I just joined them on bass because Lloyd was moving to San Francisco. So I was like, I'll fucking play bass. And, I was going out with Johnny, who was in the Vibes, and so I was quite part of that garage scene.
Yeah.
And so, it was all these sort of interconnections. And again, joining bands was just a matter of going, I'll do it.
Did these bands ever get out of the rehearsal rooms? Did you play gigs with the Bugs or the...
Oh, God. Honestly, I joined the Bugs and within like a month I was touring Germany.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. Like we did a kind of 3-week tour of Germany. I mean, it was like tiny little youth centres and things and we were sleeping on people's floors and stuff, but it was fucking great.
Yeah.
And I was meant to be on my fucking English course at the time, but I don't think anyone noticed that I was even gone. Like, it was very easy and accessible to join bands. I mean, Lush formed because me and Emma had been sort of mucking about trying to learn how to play together. And, we did have dreams of, maybe we'll be in a band one day. But I think once she was in the Rover Girls and I was in the Bugs, it sort of became a bit more kind of doable. And we didn't write songs for either of those bands. And we wanted to write songs in our own band.
Mm.
And so And again, I just asked like Chris, Mariel and Steve to join. Do you know what I mean? It wasn't like a kind of big audition process or anything. They were just mates, you know? And it was like, well, do you want to join?
There's something mentioned in the book about how there was a song about EastEnders. I need to know more about this song.
I mean, I'm actually trying to remember. Like, I probably have to dig out a diary and find what lyrics they were, because
Amazing.
It wasn't. It was awful. I don't know what I was thinking. I can't even remember a single line of it, honestly. All I seem to remember is that Doc Cotton was mentioned and Nick Cotton, but that's all I can remember.
Oh, so Doc Cotton actually was mentioned in the song?
Yeah, yeah. Amazing. I do think I got Doc Cotton and Nick Cotton in there, but I can't think what on earth I could have written the rest of that bloody song about. But yeah, all those, I think it literally was like, we've got the band, we haven't got any songs. That was how it started. It was like, okay, we'll better write some songs then. And then it's like trying to rush these songs out just so we can play a gig.
This is around 1987. And before you become Lush, you're the Baby Machines. And you've mentioned, I think, some of the people who were there. But remind us, who's in that band? Was there a kind of revolving door of people, or was it pretty solid?
No, it was, I think, I'm not sure exactly, I think we might have just had that as a name before we even had a band. And then when Chris and everyone joined, I think there was a bit of, you know, trying to find a name for a band. And I think Emma, I wish I could remember the guy's name, but I remember her saying like, oh, a friend of mine suggested this name, but he didn't have a band to attach it to. He's not in a band, and said, oh, do we want it? And it was Lush. And then we thought, oh, yeah, that's good. We'll use that.
Yeah.
Everything was so accidental. It was so... I am not a great planner, right? It's like the book. I got asked to do it and then I had to think how to do it. I didn't, you know, we didn't form this band knowing what kind of music we were going to play. We just formed it and then see, like, let's just see what happens. You know, every sort of step really of, I think... anything I've done has happened like that, you know what I mean?
So it's yourself, Emma, Chris Eklund, Steve Rippon, the original bass player, and Mariel, the original singer. And so the first gig is at the Falcon in Camden, March the 6th, 1988. Do you remember it?
Do I remember it? I mean, we played the Falcon a few times, so they all kind of merge a bit into one for me. I think Emma had started working for Jeff Barrett, who, you know, now does all that heavenly stuff. But at the time was doing press for kind of Creation and Factory, I think. And he was running this thing called the Phil Kaufman Club that was at the Falcon. And Emma was like, Emma kind of got quite in with that lot. Like, she took time out of college to kind of work for him and got quite in with that world of people and got to know them. So I think she was the one, you know, she managed to get us gigs there and, you know, knew how to get on that circuit. Like, we didn't have a fucking clue, the rest of us. So I think what I remember is we used to go to the Falcon quite a lot. I mean, do you know what? I actually did a thing last week with Debbie Googe from the Valentines, and we were reminiscing about, I mean, funny enough, the conversation started with places like the Soho House. We were talking about these kind of clubs and drinking clubs that existed. And I was just saying, well, that was kind of our drinking club.
Yeah.
Like, you would just turn up at the Falcon thinking, well, Fuzz is going to be there. Probably Joe Dilworth will turn up at some point. The Valentines will be there. Silverfish will, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It was just kind of somewhere you went where you knew you'd bump into a load of people you knew. And it was almost irrelevant who was playing. But you'd go along And there was a kind of, that was another little community of people, you know, that, I don't know, it was a little scene. And I think that Steve Sutherland ended up kind of coining that phrase, the scene that celebrates itself. So that was when those bands were getting reviewed, and he kind of, you know, I did sort of say to Debbie, like, it was such a weird thing, because it wasn't, he wasn't making a scene out of the music, because yeah. Silverfish had nothing to do with Lush musically. Mm-hmm. And but the scene itself was just bands that liked each other and hung out with each other and lent each other their equipment. And then he created a scene out of this and called it the scene that celebrates itself. And I was a bit like, why? I couldn't understand how you're making a scene out of this. Like, do you not have any fucking friends? Because this is just actually a bunch of friends. It's not actually a musical scene. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, we're so let's sort of get lumped in with the shoegaze scene.
Well, I probably didn't like it very much, because it was, first of all, the term shoegaze was a term of insult. It was Andy Ross at Food Records who coined the phrase, and coined it because he didn't like that music. He thought it was boring. I think Moose did say he thinks it happened at a Moose gig, that he was watching, I don't know, Moose, Chapter House and whoever the fuck else was playing on the bill, and going, oh, these fucking students who just stare at the floor and they're really boring and unexciting. And then that, they called that shoegaze music. So it was never intended to be like Manchester or any of those terms where everything's yeah. like, hey, that's fucking amazing. It was like, look at this shit shoegaze scene, effectively, was the you know, the moniker.
But in hindsight, that music has mostly aged really well now.
Yeah.
Those bands are revered now, aren't they?
I know. Who's fucking laughing now?
Yeah. You went to see Slow Dive last year, didn't you?
It was fantastic.
I know. It's great, isn't it?
Who would have thought that would come about?
I tell you what, never mind who would have thought. If you'd have said that to anyone at that time, they would have fucking laughed long and loud. I don't think there's a single person who would have taken you seriously. As a time traveller, if you came back yes. in time and go back in time and tell those people, you do realise that out of all of these scenes, this is the one that's going to survive, and see the reaction that you'd get. But me.
Right, Mark, true or not, did this happen or have I made it up? In the video for Can't Blame Me by Housden-born rapper Nines, he is seen wheeling past a laundrette in Willesden.
What's he wheeling on?
I think he's on a bicycle.
Wheeling past a laundrette in Willesden
Green.
I'm going to say no. I'm going to say you're leading me astray here. He wasn't wheeling. He was striding in a purposeful way.
It is true. He is indeed wheeling. So there we go. Oh. Right, Mickey, true or false? Which of the following do not have a song with Willesden in the title? The Kinks, Joe Strummer and the Mascalaros, or the Bonzo Dog Band?
I'm just going to say the second one, whatever it was, because I literally don't know.
No, the answer is the Bonzo Dog Band, who have a song called Shirt that has a lyric about Willesden Green.
Oh, okay.
The Kinks have a song called Willesden Green on the Percy film soundtrack. And Joe Strummer has a song called Willesden to Cricklewood.
Oh, okay.
Who would have thought?
I didn't know that.
No, pretty obscure. Right, at the end of each episode, we each recommend something. It could be something you've liked for a long time, something you've recently discovered. Mark, do you want to go first?
Well, you mentioned Nines earlier, and that brought something to mind. I have been obsessed the last few weeks. I've been watching, this is me getting down with the kids, Chasing Status, right? Chasing Status did a Boiler Room set, and there's a track on there which I just cannot get enough of. It's called Badadan, I think. And it's brilliant. But what I like best about it, unfortunately, some sad news. One of the hairy bikers, Dave Myers, died recently.
Yes, I saw that.
Terribly sad after a long battle with cancer. But there's the guy in Jason Statham. I don't know if it's Chase or Statham, but he's doing this Boiler Room set, and he just looks like Dave Myers to me. But he's doing all these shapes. He's doing this fantastic track. It was really banging, and all the kids in there are going mad. And I love it. So that's my current enthusiasm.
Brilliant. Do you have something to recommend for us, Mickey?
Well, given that you've said that people have picked some quite obscure things, I'm going to say that I do like cooking is my thing. I love cooking.
Right.
And my mum bought me a Japanese rice cooker. They're now available here, right?
Yeah.
But you have to make sure it's a Japanese kind of company that does these models. They're not cheap, but they are a game changer.
Wow.
So I will recommend anyone who really loves cooking. I know that there's a billion air fryers and mad fucking inventions.
We've
and
moved
slow
on
cookers.
From air fryers.
No, but you know these huge things that you invest in that take up room in your kitchen?
Yeah.
I don't have any of them, but the rice cooker is the one.
Have you yet shared any rice with your neighbour, Sean Keaveney?
I don't think I've cooked for him yet, actually.
Well, there we go.
No, I think I've been around there for like barbecues and things, but yeah.
I think I need to get one of those myself, but I'm going to recommend friend of the book club, Sian Pattenden and Pete Perfidis have a new podcast out, the Heritage Chart Show. So it's a programme on Talking Pictures that shows music clips. They pick an episode and they talk about it with a guest each week. So that's what I'm going to recommend. Theme tune by Mike Batt too.
Indeed. Yeah, we could go on forever. I think we're going to have to leave it there. But we'll pick this up because there's so much more in part two of our discussion with Mickey and our exploration of Willesden Green and wherever else. So, Mickey, a massive thanks from us. This has been brilliant, and we look forward to part two. Remember, everyone, Music Maps Podcast. Yay!